Imagine in your mind, you're drawing a line between where you are and where the training center is, and you're dropping take-up rate as you go further and further away. So the minute you cross the village boundary, we estimated that half of the entire drop you face in going 6 kilometers outside your village occurs precisely at that point. If this was a country, you would say, oh, there's an immigration official, there's a customs official, there's a border control. This is a village.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Everywhere in the world, women face invisible barriers that stop them taking up education, work, even government subsidies. In the state of Punjab in Pakistan, for example, travelling outside the local community can be a problem for women, and not just because it's hard to get around. But given these social norms that restrict travel, what could policymakers do about it? Asim Khwaja of the Harvard Kennedy School, he's also director of the Center for International Development at Harvard, is one of a team of researchers that has investigated this challenge. He joins me today to talk about these glass walls and also what works and what doesn't if we want to improve access to education and training for women. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hi, Tim. Happy to be here.
Tell me about the villages in which your research took place and the people that are living in them.
So this work was in southern Punjab in three districts, there, Bahawalpur, Bahawalnagar, and Muzaffarabad. And these districts are kind of fairly typical of, I would say, the agrarian regions in the country. They're a tad poorer than the typical district of the Punjab, in all other sense, sort of fairly typical. The individuals we're looking at are obviously women who are being offered these training opportunities, and they're drawn from a random subset of villages in these communities.
And in this context, when you offer training for women, it's not enough for policymakers to just offer this training. You have to think about whether it will be taken up. In general, in the past, have we given enough attention to this aspect?
So that's a great question. In fact, one of my pet peeves, to be honest, in this literature has been precisely that we've kind of ignored, if you will, the take-up question. We're aware of it. But often, you know, if you're just trying to fill in a bunch of seats in any program or distribute any welfare, you know, whether it be pensions for widows in India or free rice in Indonesia or training in Africa or in this case, Pakistan, you know, there's lots of needy people. And so we often get enough people to fill in the vacancies that we need. But there's often really low take-up of these programs. And the assumption usually is, well, you know, people aren't taking up the program. If in a given community only a couple of percent people take up the program, it's probably because they don't want it or they don't need it or they don't value it. And I think that's a huge assumption, which, as our work shows, is just not true.
This time round, you were offering vocational training for women in these communities. What sort of skills are you offering here?
So this is part of a really ambitious program actually funded in part by UKAID, DFID, in conjunction with the government of Punjab through a para-state outfit which had sort of public, private, and non-profit partnerships in it. And the mandate was to offer vocational skills in general, not just for women, but men also in this entire region as a way of economic uplift. And we've been collaborating with the Skills Development Authority, the kind of Punjab Skills Development Fund, for the past several years. When we started, it was a bunch of courses for men and women. The particular program we're studying in this paper actually simplified things a lot more. It restricted to what was the most popular skill demanded by women, which is actually, in this case, tailoring. The vast majority of women wanted this skill. And so we, for sake of sort of clean comparison and some of the issues we were hoping to uncover, we restricted to that skill. But just to give you an example of how design can be really helpful, when we first looked at the trainings being offered, there was a basic literacy and numeracy requirement for the skill. And we did a random survey of households' demands and needs. And we saw huge demand for a course like this. But most of the women who demanded the course didn't have the basic numeracy or literacy skills. So had you just offered the program as is, you would have excluded from the get-go precisely the group that was probably the most marginalized and hence the group of most interest in terms of raising welfare. And so we worked with a provider to kind of add very basic numeracy and literacy components to the standard offerings, including a bit of financial literacy, enough so that you could become an effective tailor in your community. And so that was just a small insight to say even small design interventions like these, if you understand what forms the basis of exclusion earlier on, can actually be easily adjusted and lead to a lot more inclusion than it would otherwise have occurred.
And given the popularity of the skill that you are offering here, the training that you are offering here, you know that all else being equal, if it were feasible, then you would get a very high take-up of this training program.
Indeed, this was actually a really interesting learning experience, both for us and for UK Aid as a donor and for the government of Punjab on saying, how do you do sort of deliberative design? In a typical course, people would show up and you wouldn't even know whether there's low or high take up. Our design was fundamentally different. We started off with what we would call a needs assessment, where we went to these communities, randomly surveyed households, went into the households, talked to men and women, asked them what they needed help in terms of vocational trainings. Basically, in 90% of the households, they wanted both men and women in their household to be trained. In fact, when we did a pilot of this project, and this is where the real shocker came in and sort of the realization that something was off in our basic assumptions. Mm-hmm. So imagine 90% of people want training. We go there, we actually offer a training opportunity, and 50% of the people from those 90% sign up. That looks pretty reasonable because, you know, you all got busy. This is an actual course. It's happening in 2 weeks. You want it, but you're tied up in life and so on and so forth. That wasn't a surprise. What was a real surprise is once those 50% had signed up, eventually, only 5% of them actually showed up to take the course.
Wow.
And that drop was just mind-boggling, and we just couldn't understand it. And it just wasn't consistent with this idea of people don't really want the training, and they've expressed demand. And we got some pushback from some of the earlier policy counterparts saying, look, maybe it was just cheap talk. Maybe women just were saying this, or men were saying this, because this was a socially acceptable thing to do. Our conjecture, as we did more and more focus groups, was that wasn't the case. Women would cite very specific obstacles about why they were unable to come. And that's what got us really thinking about access being a fundamental problem that we first had to address. And I would argue it's a problem not just for a program like ours, but frankly, for any welfare program. But we never uncover it because you never do this design approach where you go do a representative survey of households and first ask them what they want. You don't track households in the way we did it. And so I think you never typically uncover this issue.
So when you did this intervention, how did it affect the take-up when you asked women to travel outside their village to do the training compared to if it was offered in their village?
It was shocking. Basically, we changed take-up rates by 4 times. I mean, that's how big a difference is. So if the course was outside your village, and I'm not saying, you know, going to the city in some faraway remote area, I'm talking about traveling 5 or 6 kilometers to a larger village nearby, something which is very feasible to do. There's transport available. So it's not like a typical remote areas where you had to hike for 8 hours to reach someplace. It's nothing like that. The take-up, if it was an average of, say, 6 kilometers away, was about 7 or 8%. For course completion, despite the huge interest that I said earlier. And that 7% or so went up to something on the order of 36%, just by moving that course from 6 kilometers outside to inside your village, where you also had to typically walk, right? It's not your villages are small, so you might have to travel 1 kilometer or 2 kilometers there anyways.
So we can't explain this difference in take-up by the fact that it's maybe just not easy to get around.
You know, here's the interesting thing. The way the study was designed is, and this is to our knowledge, it is the first study where we randomize location of the training center. And what that allows us to do in the spirit of this year's Nobel Prize in Development Economics, it's a randomized controlled trial. And because we randomized distance, we can precisely estimate this distance equation, if you will, this distance drop-off. And what was really stark is, it's one thing to say this distance drop-off was more severe than you'd expect if you just did like a basic economic accounting for, say, opportunity cost of time or actual cost of travel, which we did. We did all those calculations. But even more stark than that is, imagine in your mind, you're drawing a line between where you are and where the training center is. And as you go further and further away, you have this line which is dropping down, just like a gravity equation would give you. You're dropping take-up rate as you go further and further away. Hmm. What was really fascinating is this line had a discontinuity. So the minute you cross the village boundary, we estimated that half of the entire drop you face in going 6 kilometers outside your village occurs precisely at that point. So it's an invisible boundary, which is why we call the paper glass walls. But everyone knows that you've exited the village. And so something like that is just impossible to reconcile with anything economic, because you need a force which is discontinuous at the village boundary. If this was a country, you would say, oh, there's an immigration official, there's a customs official, there's a border control. This is a village, and you're moving to the next village, right? So there's no like toll booth, there's no patrol, there's at least not physically present, but clearly it felt in people's minds, or at least in the community's mind, as if there was a border.
And this internal border control, does it exist with the same power for all women, or are some types of women more likely to still attend the course?
Yeah, so that was fascinating. So there was variation, right? There was both variation at the individual level, but also variation at the community level. And so let me give you a few examples. So at the individual level, women who had more agency, more control, if you will, within the household in terms of self-reported decision-making within the household faced less of this barrier. I should say the barriers we're talking about are not new information for people who are in gender studies or sociology or anthropology, where done really rich narratives.
Yes.
They talk a lot about this. All we've done is just very precisely quantify that and show how severe this obstacle is in a magnitude sense of the word. But consistent with that, what we find is fascinating. We find women who are from poorer households actually face a smaller barrier. So if this was about economics, you would think it would be the opposite, right? It would be richer women who'd face a smaller barrier. And when you look at some of the richer kind of social anthropology around this, people talk a lot about poorer people don't have status, right? And so if you think this was about loss of status in some social norm sense, well, if you don't have status, then you don't have anything to lose.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, this is where economic struggles, very difficult for us to fully nail down mechanisms. But in the more qualitative work that people have done, it's very consistent with this idea. We also find communities which are more ethnically diverse in terms of more castes in the community, more in the Pakistani context, it's less castes, it's zats. Biradris, which are like familial groupings, kind mm-hmm. of like caste in India, but somewhat different. Where you have more diversity, women from those villages also face less of a barrier.
Now, I know you also did some work on what it would take to bring down these glass walls, remove them. As economists, first of all, the first thing we reach for is some financial incentive.
Indeed.
So that would involve compensating the household, the family. Does this work?
It does, you know, but it's very costly.
Right.
So we wanted to estimate this precisely. And often the way we do it in economics is we'll value things like opportunity cost. We'll try and figure out this number using a bunch of assumptions. We actually were able to do somewhat better than that. We actually could vary the financial stipend at the individual level. So this course was not only just free, I should have mentioned that at the beginning, but it actually had a monthly stipend with it. So you were actually paid to study. And that stipend was about 1,500 rupees a month, which is a pretty decent amount. For some people, we randomly raised that to as much as 6,000 rupees a month. So we could see how much does it take to get you to cross the barrier. And what was shocking for us, and this is just an idea of how severe this is we estimate using this variation that simply to cross the barrier, it would cost you around 4,000 rupees a month.
Wow.
Just to get the women to make that virtual jump. I'm not saying the distance. It's 4,000 rupees to cross the barrier and about 300 rupees for every additional kilometer. And even that 300 rupees, if you compare with like actual travel costs, it's an order of magnitude higher than what that would be. So even there, there's clearly this social force happening. And this is a way of saying, look, you can throw money at it, but it's clearly not addressing the economic issues. It's a compensation for whatever social barrier you face. And hence, you have to compensate multiples of what the actual economic cost would have been.
So what can we do instead?
That's the billion-dollar question, I would say. And it's fascinating. And I must say, there's stuff we can say about it, which we did, and other stuff which is still an area of inquiry for us, and I think an important area for inquiry for the field, I would argue. So when we came up with this basic design, we also said, look, we were aware of some of these barriers. So we did a whole bunch of focus groups, try and figure out what are the forms of this barrier. And what emerged is, obviously, in some cases, things like financial constraints emerge, which is why we did the increased stipend for some women and see what happens. We also introduced three more design variations. One was, in finance, we say there's an equity premium puzzle, which we're afraid of investing outside. When you look at investments, say, outside your country in equity markets, it seems like there's a huge risk people perceive in that investment, given how few investments we make. And so the idea is, well, it's the fear of the unknown. Right? You can imagine a similar thing happening over here. You just don't know. It's some other village somewhere. You don't know what the training center is like. You don't know what the course is like. You're a bit concerned about it. They're just concerns one has. So one of the treatments we did was we did a very elaborate information treatment where we sat down for a couple of hours with the potential trainees in the village, explained everything to them, answered all their concerns, had testimonials from other women who'd taken the courses, had these women visit the training center, which was outside their village. So whatever concerns you might have, we allayed them. So we call this kind of a trainee engagement treatment, but think of it as a huge information provision to allay any of these concerns. We did a second variation of this where, in addition to the individual trainees, We also invited elders from the community, community members. So our view was maybe the concerns aren't coming from the individual person, but from society at large. And so someone says, look, I'm a bit worried about our daughters, our sisters, or our wives going to these areas. And so we need to be reassured. And so in that, we again invited them, had lots of meetings, had what would be called a community engagement kind of forum, even a community mobilization, if I will. And we even took community members in buses to where the training was going to be to just check out the facilities. Look, it's safe. It's a clean facility. And then the third thing we did was we offered group transport. Pakistan has these very popular modes of transport called chinchis now. It's like a rickshaw, but it's a motorbike with a sort of a larger section attached to it, which can seat maybe 4 to 5 people on it. So we arranged secure transport from the village where the women were coming from to the training center, wherever the training center was, 6-7 kilometers is the average distance between them. So those were the three design variations we did. The first two had no effect. Oh. Whatsoever. In fact, if anything, somewhat perversely, the first one, while it didn't affect eventual class completion rates, it actually lowered initial interest. There's a stage where we have to accept the voucher, sort of indicate your interest to be trained before you actually show up to the training. And what we think is happening there is the community meeting didn't address the social concerns, but simply elevated them earlier on in the process. So if you would have normally dropped out in a couple of weeks, in that first meeting, you're like, gosh, there are all these concerns people are raising. I'm not even going to express interest. So it's telling us that whatever force this is that is blocking women is not an individual force. It didn't get affected by the individual meeting. It's a force which comes into play when society starts weighing in on this individual's decision. And the thing which did work, so the good news is, group transport worked fabulously. It's very interesting for us why that worked. And again, the devil sometimes is in the details. It wasn't just like some outside transport facility, which would have been the cost-efficient thing to do. Contracted with some large transport authority, said, these are 100 or so villages. Can you have a 3-month contract for the course and you bring in nice formal transport? We kind of, and that would be my instinct as a designer, because I wanted like a stable, secure, you get scale economies, the whole good things that economics brings to the table. That's not something the villagers wanted. When we discussed with them, they wanted someone from their village to take them. It was very interesting. And there was a whole discussion on who the driver would be. And so our interpretation is that that sense of a secure transport, a known transport, right? And the driver is typically a male, in fact, almost 100% be men. So there's a male from the village taking, you know, 4 to 5 women in their transport, and there are multiple transports because there are more than that many women from each village, to this training center. And that started revealing to us what the nature of this constraint was. It's almost felt as if that security of the village, think of that as now a bubble which surrounds this public transport from the village. So it's as if a little piece of the village bubbled itself out, went to the other village, stayed there for the duration of the course, and came back. It's both interesting, but it's also a bit sobering, right? Because it's telling you how substantial these constraints are. And look, changing norms is not something that one can do in any short duration or in any easy way. And this was just an indication of that.
Yes, if these social norms are so slow to change, will the glass walls that you've observed ever be torn down?
It's a very deep question. This is beyond the scope of what we did. For us, success was, the way we think of the contribution to this work is first to really document precisely how substantial this constraint is. Right? In a very clean, in a way an economist was in a causal inference, in a clean empirical way. So we validated a lot of the qualitative work, and then we've made the magnitude really precise. We've put this in precise numbers that policymakers can understand, which is money, right? How much does it cost? Or how many women are you excluding? These are very precise numbers. And also, I think the idea that group transport is powerful is very consistent with some really fabulous work that has started happening on transport for women. Erica Feel has some great work. Girja Borkar and the World Bank has some great work. There's a lot of work now saying how it's so important in societies like these with somewhat conservative norms for women to have dedicated female transport. Like the same access barriers I'm talking about in vocational training will happen everywhere. In fact, even in this program, once the women had learned how to stitch, we have subsequent follow-ups where we then, if you're going to sell your product, you're going to have another access barrier. So we connected them in the same way virtually to marketplaces. Now, to your question, How will society change? Will this always be the way? So one way to think about the treatment that worked, this group transport, is we chickened out. You didn't quite break the glass wall, but you simply made it pliable. It became like a soft wall. So it kind of bubbled out. And I think the deeper question for us is that a cop-out? By doing that, did you permit, admit, allow a conservative norm to survive, which otherwise would have broken down under society's pressures? Or is it the opposite? Is it that when you try and go head against these norms, you can't break the glass wall, you just make it stronger? When you shatter your head against it and it doesn't break, someone tries to make it thicker so you won't shatter your head again. Do norms change incrementally? What would be really fascinating for us, and we'd love to do this, is follow these women 5 or 10 years or these villages down the line. The fact is that these women were able to go out. When they came back with that experience, does the village look different from another year? That woman's younger sister now, is she more able to go? Because she can say, look, my elder sister went. Nothing happened to her. Yes, she went in this little bubble. But if she was fine and the bubble was kind of not quite the village, can I go without the bubble? Or can I go in a weaker bubble? And, you know, and I think of how parents and children interact with each other. Like, I feel I have teenagers now, and I see the same thing, that my teenagers are just testing these walls, right? Mm. They're beginning to gain independence. And we give them gradual, okay, why don't you do this? Okay, fine, you can have a sleepover. Okay, now you can go out for a week. You know, my perhaps overly optimistic hope is that this is a more organic and gradual way to get norms to change in a way that you bring along society as opposed to pit yourself against at least some members of society. But, you know, to be honest, I'm an empiricist. It's an open empirical question.
Well, it's very interesting work and potentially hugely important. I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more about it. But Asim, thank you for telling us about it today.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for doing this. And for everyone out there who is striving against their own glass walls, men, women, minorities, whoever you are, I have the best wishes for you and hope you're able to transcend your walls as well.
Well said. And now the paper, if you want to read it, and I'm sure everyone does want to read it after that, is called Glass Walls: Experimental Evidence on Access Constraints Faced by Women. And the authors are Ali Chima, Asim Khwaja, Farouk Nasir, and Jacob Shapiro. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on your podcast platform. You'll never miss an episode, or you can find our past episodes at voxdev.org.